Hello, and welcome to another episode of my podcast, The Global Agora. My name is Andrej Matyshak, and I work as the Deputy Head of Foreign Desk in Slovak Daily Pravda, which, by the way, means truth, and it's not Russian Pravda. What is Ukraine facing? What is Russia learning? Is it possible that Ukraine will lose the war as soon as this year? Mick Ryan is a military strategist and retired Australian Army Major General, and he explains why we have to talk about the worst scenario. We also discuss Ukraine's mobilization efforts and demography, and what the West has to do to help Kyiv. Listen to our conversation. If you enjoy what I do, please support me on Ko-fi. For the link, see also a description of this episode. And now, up to the new debate.
The commander-in-chief of Ukraine's armed forces, General Oleksandr Siersky, said that the situation on the front line has worsened and reported that Russian forces has achieved some tactical success in the Donetsk region, but could not gain an operational advantage. How should the public understand the situation when the military talks about tactical gains of Russians? Basically, how bad is the situation?
I think the situation in the east is very perilous for the Ukrainians at the moment. It's no secret that their brigades on the front line are very short of manpower, that they're extraordinarily short of firepower. The Russians have 5, sometimes 7, 10-to-1 advantage. And these two things are very telling in tactical operations. And they would be major contributors to why we've seen in the past 48 hours the Russians make pretty significant tactical gains in the east around a couple of towns, in particular their efforts to envelop the town of Chasiv Yar. So the Ukrainians are in trouble tactically. I'm not sure the Russians are going to make some kind of grand breakthrough that will see them, you know, gain dozens of kilometers, but they are making ground slowly but surely at the cost of many hundreds of Russian lives and armored vehicles, of course.
What would it mean for the trajectory of the whole invasion if Russia would be able to gain a real advantage, like you said, maybe to move forward dozens of kilometers?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of grim scenarios at the moment for the Ukrainians. They delayed building defensive lines in the east. They've been doing it, but they're nowhere near finished, like the Russians were in the south by the time the Ukrainians launched their counteroffensive. So if the Russians are able to punch their way through these, they'll be into open ground in the east, and that will be very dangerous for the Ukrainians because it means the Ukrainians certainly have already lost the initiative in the east. The Russians are calling the shots there. And the more gains the Russians can make, the greater tempo they can generate, and the more difficult it will become for the Ukrainians to patch holes, to conduct counter-penetration operations with whatever reserves they had. So, you know, the Ukrainians at the moment facing some real dilemmas, and it's going to come down to, do they fight to keep ground and lose a lot of soldiers, or do they give up more ground and keep what soldiers they have in the hope that they can retake that ground, you know, in the coming days or weeks? So there's multiple dilemmas for Ukrainian operational and strategic commanders at the moment. But the more ground Russia takes, the more difficult it is for the Ukrainians militarily, but also more difficult it gets for the Ukrainians politically with gaining support, military support, as well as diplomatic support.
It's interesting what you're saying about those dilemmas, and especially about holding grounds or somewhat save the soldiers, because I just talked to Ukrainian security analyst Vladimir Dubovik from Odessa University, and he said basically the same thing, that Ukraine faces the dilemma of whether to save territory or villages and towns or military personnel. So looking at the situation on the battlefield, how would you solve this?
I don't see how they're going to reconcile those two very different demands, keeping soldiers, keeping ground. And both are very problematic from a military point of view, because the Russians might take ground that's very strategic and allows them to undertake more expansive offensive operations in the summer. But losing lots of soldiers is also difficult because somehow you've got to reconstitute your forces. And we shouldn't forget both of them are politically difficult for President Zelensky, who's only just got these mobilization legislation through. It's going to take time to mobilize more people. And it's going to take time for this American assistance to flow in, even if they were well prepared beforehand. So, you know, the next few weeks are going to be enormously trying for the Ukrainian armed forces, particularly in the east, from both a ground and an air perspective.
So what do you see when you look at the Russians? How sophisticated is what they're doing in terms of military tactics? Are they momentarily successful, first of all, due to the fact that they can and more and more soldiers and their war economy is working? Or are they doing something, as I said, maybe something very sophisticated?
It's sophisticated enough. It was all about relative strengths, not absolute. The Russians, the longer this war has gone on, have become better at learning. They're becoming faster at learning and improving their battlefield performance. Now, it's from a very low base, but still, they've learned a lot and they're applying it. You know, they're reforming divisions to better coordinate brigades, which is important. They have different kinds of infantry, from the meat infantry to through to their better VDV troops and then special forces troops. They're getting much better at integrating ground troops with the use of these long-range glide bombs, which cause enormous damage. I mean, artillery might suppress troops on the ground and cause some destruction, but these glide bombs are very, very destructive indeed. All these elements go into an evolved operating methodology that the Russians have developed. They tried it at Vukovar. You know, they learned a lot there. They failed a lot, but they learned. They failed a lot and then learned at Avdiivka. And they're applying these lessons. They seem to be better at a top-down approach to adaptation and then marrying that with industrial development. You know, they mobilized back in September 2022, which means they've got artillery shells flowing in a way Ukraine never has. So all these things have gone in to see the Russians become far more militarily effective at the tactical and the operational levels. And that should worry us because the Russian army that exists now did not exist 2 years ago. It is a better institution. And the longer this war goes, the more it's going to improve, the better it's going to be, and the greater threat it's going to be, not just to Ukraine, but to other European countries.
I will come back to this point. But in terms of Ukraine, you just, as I understand, you've just been there a long time ago.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So can you maybe say a few takeaways from your trip? How is military basically reacting on what you just said? But maybe also about the mood in the country, if you can say a few words about this.
I think people, citizens, military, government, they're fatigued. I mean, anyone having to endure this for 26 months would be deeply fatigued, and as we know, that's cumulative. And there was a degree of frustration. Now, this was obviously in the lead up to the US House of Representatives passing the aid bill, but there was a degree of frustration in the lead up to that, notwithstanding the enormous gratitude to European countries who have stepped up, Baltics, Scandinavian country, you know, countries like Denmark, which are providing enormous amounts of aid, Germany, Latvia, Estonia, Sweden and others, Poland. So, you know, there's a mix of fatigue and frustration. I wouldn't call it defeatism. I don't perceive that. You know, the Ukrainians are very hardy, smart and tough and will fight on. But there was a weariness I perceive. When it comes to the war, you know, my sense is the current strategy being pursued by the West can't succeed. Our strategy is to support the defense of Ukraine. We need to shift to a strategy which is about beating Russia in Ukraine. That's different because it's a different mindset, requires different resourcing. And we really need to shift to that as quickly as we possibly can. I think helping Ukraine defend itself is treading water. Helping Ukraine beat Russia is a very different thing. So we need to make that shift. So, you know, I've always got grounds for optimism when I go to Ukraine, but there is a fatigue and frustration that's present there at the moment, I think.
Mate, but, you know, what you just said, that we have to shift our mindset towards beating Russia, not just to defending Ukraine. You know, frankly speaking, and I'm not telling you anything new, frankly speaking, people like you are saying that for quite some time, there were no political decisions. Yep. And as you said, now Russian military armed forces are much better prepared. Their economy is on war footing. So in fact, made those decisions maybe 1 year ago, it would be easier. Now, honestly, I don't see the will to do it. Do you see it?
Well, you know, I don't disagree. I mean, I think the end of 2022, Russia was really reeling. I think in many respects, if we had a double down at that point in time, this would be a very different war right now. But we kind of let the Russians get out of Kherson. We allowed them to entrench in the south. That saved the Russians. And the big lesson from this war is when you have your boot on the neck of your enemy, keep pushing down. Don't take the boot off, which is what I think we did at the end of 2022, whether it was cause of delays in aid to Ukraine or dithering over were tanks escalatory and these kind of crazy debates, which now look quaint, but at the time seem important to certain politicians. You know, the West really needs to decide, does it want Ukraine to win or not? Because at the moment, it doesn't appear to me that they've made that decision. It appears to me that they're giving aid, but not quite sure what they desire to come from all that. Now, to be fair, I've spoken to many Ukrainians saying, well, we need to develop our own theory of victory. You know, what does winning look like for Ukraine? And that is also a reasonable critique, which some Ukrainians are making of their own approach. But at the end of the day, the US and NATO need to double down and commit to helping Ukraine win, or this is just going to be a long, drawn-out conflict that works in Russia's favor as well as China's favor.
There is a mobilization effort at this moment, but I know it is not politically easy, but do you think that authorities in Kyiv should be more aggressive in forcing Ukrainians into the military, or could it backfire? Because in any case, even with more Western weapons, Ukraine also needs more soldiers, isn't it?
Absolutely. Ukraine needs more soldiers. I mean, the modern battlefield, unfortunately, has a high cost in both lives as well as munitions and drones. These are the three big things that are consumed in large numbers. The problem Ukraine has, and I think a lot of Western commentators don't appreciate this, is you need to look at Ukrainian demographics. Because of a big drop-off in birth rates in the immediate wake of the Cold War, there's a few age cohorts between, you know, 15 to 30, where there's a huge shortfall in people. It's very obvious when you have a look at Ukraine's demographic tree. On top of that, they lost 10 to 15% of their population at the start of the war, so they're starting well behind the eight ball when it comes to mobilizing their people. That's not an excuse, it's just these are considerations that need to be taken into account when looking at the Ukrainian approach to conscription. Now, of course, the Ukrainians also are developing an indigenous defense industry that requires workers, generally, a lot of them around the same age, particularly those building drones and munitions and things like this. So there's this mega trade-off in where you allocate people in a war effort like this. During the Second World War, the US looked at this particular problem. At what percentage of your population could you mobilize for a war? And they came up with a figure of about no more than 10%. I'm not sure where Ukraine is at the moment. It's probably not close to 10%, but it's also starting with a very different demography than what the United States had during the Second World War. So at some point, they will come up again a natural limit of how many young people you can recruit into the armed forces if you want the rest of the society to operate.
Do you think that Russia is also considering this, or it doesn't matter?
It clearly doesn't matter as much, and he's clearly drawing on a lot of Russia's ethnic populations. But at the end of the day, even those different populations, these are not infinite resources. At some point, they will start running out of people. I mean, Russia's jails, from what I've been told, are essentially empty. You know, there's a lot of ethnic populations and lost a large proportion of young people. I mean, that is not a resource that can be exploited forever at the current rate. I mean, the Russians are losing, according to at least the last UK intelligence brief on this, somewhere in the region of 800 to 1,000 troops a day, killed and wounded. Now, they're able to recruit 30,000 a month, but you've got to wonder just how long they can do that for, even for a country the size of Russia. So even Putin will want to win this war in the next couple of years. He won't want a forever war because eventually it will drain his country of an entire generation.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think he doesn't care. But let's see, as you said.
No, I don't think he does.
Yeah. So, Mick, I know those are maybe just anecdotal things, but still, what are the lessons for the West when we see that Kiev pulls back Abrams tanks from the battlefield, or that the ground launch small diameter bombs don't work because of the signal jamming and harsh, muddy environment?
I'll start with the second one first. I mean, we've known for quite some time that the Russians have been using electronic warfare and GPS jammers to degrade the performance of those precision munitions who use this for guidance. So it's not just ground launch small diameter bombs. HIMARS is certainly not as effective as it used to be because of these measures. We know that 80% of Ukrainian drones never reach their mission objective because of things like electronic warfare. So this is part of a very sophisticated electromagnetic warfare complex that the Russians have been developing for decades. And, you know, they've learned a lot about, and they've honed it to a very high degree of effectiveness in Ukraine. That's one area we really need to look at and learn from. On the M1s, now, I commanded a mechanized brigade. I had an M1 battalion. M1s are not designed to sit on the front line in the defense. That is not what tanks are designed for. In this kind of static defensive regime, armored vehicles are not supposed to be on the front line. They're supposed to be held well back from the front line. They comprise reserves and, most importantly, counter penetration forces. So if the enemy is able to launch a breakthrough, you can use armored forces to rapidly respond and cut off and destroy that penetration. It appears that potentially some tanks were being used as armored pillboxes on the front line. It is entirely unsurprising they were targeted. That is not what they're designed for. So it's not a commentary on the M1. They are very fine tanks. It's a commentary on perhaps inexperienced or desperate commanders using them in ways they're not designed for.
Russia can be defeated, and the West has a choice whether to do so in Ukraine or on the Polish border. This is what Polish Foreign Minister Radoslaw Sikorski just said. So how much are you concerned that if Russia will be successful in Ukraine, it won't stop there?
Well, I think the Poles are very concerned. I know I've been to Poland more times in the last 2 years than I ever expected to in my entire life. And I'm able to speak to a lot of senior officials there. And they're deeply concerned because they know if Russia is successful in Ukraine, not only will it be a more experienced and battle-tested Russian army, but it will be one that's emboldened to continue to be aggressive against its neighbours. And as the head of the Polish Institute for International Affairs said several weeks ago, you know, he said, if we appease Russia, we in Poland know exactly what that results in. It results in Polish people in rail cars, and we're not going to do that. So, you know, Poland and the Baltic states in particular, who have long experience dealing with Russia, understand how they think way better than an Australian or an American or a British might, know exactly where the potential defeat of Ukraine might lead, and it leads to their doorsteps. And it's something they're deeply concerned about, and it's the reason why they have been so forward-leaning and so generous with supporting Ukraine.
So we hear that from politicians now, that even from military people, that Russia might be ready to attack NATO. So Moscow denied it. But I also have heard interesting take on such warnings, that they are sending signals to Moscow that the alliance is scared. What do you think about it?
Yeah, it's interesting. I, you know, if you stand by and watch something happen, you're supporting it. I don't think NATO's scared. I think NATO's doing everything it possibly can within the bounds of the political direction it gets from key countries, whether it's the United States, Germany, Britain and others. I don't think NATO's scared at all. Indeed, I think Russia is scared of NATO. It has not moved the conflict outside the borders of Ukraine. It knows that NATO collectively has a military that's far larger, far more capable, and has an economy that's far more resilient than the Russian one. But when it comes to countries like the Baltics, we could present NATO with a fait accompli very quickly, and that would place NATO in a very significant dilemma. Now, it would have an obligation to do something, but we really don't know what that might mean. I mean, geography still matters, and if Russia was able to take it, and, you know, NATO has to move some distance to liberate the Baltic states, that would be a very interesting and difficult proposition.
Yeah, I think in a way we can, there is a possibility that we can face the same dilemma as Ukrainians are facing now, to save the territory or maybe to save some soldiers. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. Although the Ukraine can trade space and time, and the Baltics can't. I mean, the Baltics are very small. They have next to no strategic depth. I mean, their strategic depth is NATO. So you don't want the Russians to be in a position to start anything, because once they start rolling, momentum alone might carry them across the entirety of the Baltic nations, notwithstanding, you know, what would be a very heroic and stout defense by the military that's there. You know, one thing that might be deterring the Russians is the forward deployed NATO forces in those Baltic states. And you're seeing an expansion of that. You know, the Canadians are about to lead a brigade there, the Brits, a whole lot of others. So that might be the thing that is scaring the Russians off. At least I hope so.
How much are you worried that even with the parade coming from the US, from the others, the UK just also announced a big military package, how much are you worried that Ukraine might lose the war this year?
I mean, war's full of uncertainties, and you can never say for certain, you know, Ukraine will definitely win or will definitely lose. And strategists have to consider the full range of options, and one is within the range of possibilities, Ukraine losing. Now, I don't think that will happen this year. I think the worst that could happen is Russia would take more territory. But it's worth us thinking about it, because if you can think of it, think through how that might happen, you can then think through, well, how do we take action now to make sure it doesn't? So we shouldn't close our minds off to these things just because we support Ukraine and love the courage and the resilience of the Ukrainian people. We can help them by thinking through lots of different possibilities and ensuring the worst of them don't take place.
This was another episode of my podcast, The Global Agora. Subscribe, listen on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and on the other platforms. If you enjoy what I do, please support me on Ko-fi. For the link, see also the description of this episode. Thank you for listening and stay tuned.